I'm Steve Sanderford with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today is September the 24th, about 11:14 in the morning. I'm accompanied by various members of the FCIC. We're at the offices of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve to interview Jim Embersett. The interview will be recorded. Mr. Embersett, could I get your consent on the record?
Yes, I give my consent.
Thank you. We'll go around the room. Everybody state your name, spell your last name to be clear, and I'll start. I'm Steve Sanderford. I'm on loan from the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, working in the research area for the FCIC.
I'm Randall Dodd, DODD. I am staff at FCIC.
I'm Jim Embersett. I'm Deputy Associate Director for Credit, Market, and Operational Risk Policy and the Banking Supervision Division of the Federal Reserve. Shall I spell my name?
Yes.
My last name is spelled E-M-B-E-R-S-I-T.
Dave Caperton, Federal Reserve Board, C-A-P-E-R-T-O-N.
Stephen Mintz, M-I-N-T-Z, staff of the FCIC.
Quick background. The commission was established by statute signed into law by the president. It's bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. The FCIC is charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institution. It's charged with writing a report, which is due to Congress by December 15th. In addition, I think these interviews are a critical aspect of the work of the commission, interviewing experts such as yourself about the complex capital markets transactions. So that's the interview.
Great.
Just wanted to ask you,
sure.
Trying to understand better how the Fed was trying to monitor risk prior to and during the crisis. And so I just want to understand that that process better. And so, you know, we're one thing we wanted to ask was how much you looked at individual firms and how they were managing. I guess at that time you were focusing on market risk and not your broader authority today?
Yes. Primarily the area that I headed up from right, you know, prior to the crisis and growths up until July, mid-July of this year, was the market and liquidity risk section of the banking supervision. That particular area was responsible for monitoring general risks in general market and liquidity risk taken by banking organizations, developing policies, procedures, and efforts to enhance and promote the consistency of supervision across the Federal Reserve System. There were, at the time, and you're talking about monitoring individual institutions, you know, there's an organizational structure that was established. And especially if we're talking about the large institutions, it's called the Large Financial Institutions Group, the LFI group, that was primarily focused on the supervision and the monitoring of risks around those largest institutions. I'm not sure of what the date in which that particular organization was established. I'm assuming you already have a lot of this background.
Yes.
So stop me if I'm repeating things that
we kind of get like people say, yeah, but we don't remember all of it. No one seems to remember all of it. So anything you can add, that would be great.
That's right.
I mean, these are all things. I mean, there are certain issues that are factual.
That's right.
Which you could, you know, which we could go through the records, which I don't have a record of right here.
That's right.
Regarding.
Exactly.
You know, when the LFI was established,
yep.
And what the processes and procedures were, how it operated, the ongoing process of that,
yep.
Of that group. So I can tell you about that particular group and how that ran.
I think of particular interest is how market liquidity risk fit into that, you know, into the supervisory programs, how you interfaced with the team at Citi or Wachovia or B of A, you know, in terms of, you know, and I guess we are focused on the largest institutions more so than, you know, right, community banks.
Right. But backing up a little further, we're assuming that you're speaking for what you know right now. We didn't ask you to do any research to come in here.
That's right.
So it's not a deposition. We're trying to learn from you.
Oh, okay.
And so we're trying to kind of we think of it more as picking your brain.
Okay.
Than anything else.
Okay.
So please, we don't need to make you feel uncomfortable that way.
Sure.
I've already written them.
I was going to say, you've been here and you've
been
so you're aware.
But your recollection of
so I don't want to.
That's right.
Okay, we can spend 3 hours just me repeating what you guys already know.
But it's how it affects you and Mark.
Yeah, so to a certain extent, and as you're aware, that the Federal Reserve operates on a very decentralized process, that the actual supervision, on-site supervision, is carried out by the reserve banks. So the direct ongoing monitoring of the individual risk exposures at those institutions was conducted by the on-site teams, which then fed up to an overall broader committee, the LFI committee. There were, you know, the market and liquidity risk, what were our roles, that we had, you know, several roles at the time. One key role was to help promote consistency of market risk supervision across the system. Those significant efforts there involved outreach to the market and liquidity risk coordinators or subject matter experts that were on each individual team, working with them on training, on helping them understand certain issues. And in, at the very least, at least once a year, reviewing their supervisory plans and their roll-up or their annual assessments of the risk exposures of the banking organizations, both the inherent risks and the mitigated risks.
How would you distinguish those? Help me out there.
Well, there's it's pretty standard in these concepts were first developed by the Treadway Commission in, you know, developing risk management, whatever. But when you're looking at risk in an institution, you first look at the inherent risk. Given the business, what is the inherent risk of the business that they're in? Is it, you know, what are the market dynamics that are going on in that business? What are the basic functional and income generators? What are the volatilities of that income? Things that are generally not in control, not specifically in control of the institution. So once there's an assessment of inherent risks, then you overlay the risk management processes and the governance structures that institutions set up around that to, and based on those evaluations of the risk management, the internal controls, the limits, the audit processes, the entire spectrum of our supervisory process that's being covered, then you make an assessment of what is the overall risk. So there's the inherent risk, and then there's the risk subject to management. How well is it being managed and mitigated? Things like that. But that's maybe a little bit off the point. The issue here is that every year, as part of the supervisory LFI supervisory process, there was, you know, annual reviews, roll-ups, what they were called. There was planning for the coming year of what type of examinations were going to be conducted. We would review those. We would be asked to review those. You know, my superior, I during the LFI process, I had two superiors. One was David Wright up until 2006, and John Greenlee starting in May of 2007. Both of those individuals sat on what was called an LFI
committee. I want to say it's the committee on my memory. It's a management committee. It was the LFI management committee. And it was within that management committee, there were a number of efforts undertaken. I'm sure you're aware of perspectives on risk documents, things like that.
I think we have those documents.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So I was involved in that, but you know my section also got involved with also coordinating and promoting consistency in the implementation of the capital rules surrounding trading risk. David Lynch right now is head of a business line that I have in that. Basically, the sections that I oversaw were broken up into several different business lines. One had to do with trading operations, and in the trading operations that included counterparty credit risk. And for more than 10 years, I'd say maybe going back 15 years, in the various forms of the particular section that I oversaw, there were always business lines that were directed at trading operations and counterparty credit risk, treasury operations, which include asset liability management, investment management, and interest rate risk management. Those are functions that occur in treasury functions. In the early, starting around 2003, we've more formally approached mortgage banking as a particular business line. We also had a private equity. We looked at the time, especially prior to the crisis, there were, and coming out of GLIBA, where there were new merchant banking rule powers granted to bank holding companies. So we had a private equity area, and of course, so not only were we involved in supervision, but we were also involved in developing policy, and both on an interagency basis as well as involved in international policy. Going all the way back to the 90s, I was involved in the development in the Basel Committee on developing the market risk amendment for trading activities. And then once that was implemented in the U.S., reserve banks, as they were charged with approving models, whatever, would have to coordinate those model approvals through board staff. So that was one function. And of course, my area also got involved in broad interagency policy and broad Federal Reserve policy, dealing with any number of issues. So we were subject matter experts in these particular areas. So in the 90s, when Bankers Trust had issues, we were involved in that. When LTCM had the issues, we were involved in that. In 9/11, we were involved in those recovery efforts, for lack of a better term. The other thing that we would be involved with on an interagency basis, in addition to working with the OCC and the FDIC on general coordination of supervisory processes, whatever, my unit was also involved in work of the PWG, Prisons Working Group. And I'm sure you're aware that prior to the crisis, and especially after LTCM, there was a keen focus on hedge funds. Looking back, one could say there was almost probably too much of a focus on hedge funds at the time, but nevertheless, so we were involved very much in a lot of the PWG work that was done around hedge funds, or at least we were the Fed staff that input into the chairman's participation in the PWG. This is kind of the general overview. Maybe I can stop there.
Can I get in? I forgot to say at the beginning that the conversation is covered under our confidentiality agreement. I just want to get that on the record. Sorry for that.
Particularly for me, I can't even talk to myself. So.
Right, exactly. All right, okay.
Not out loud. Can we go back? One area I didn't realize that your group covered was the mortgage banking.
interest. You know, there was a lot of guidance, the non-traditional mortgage guidance. There was a guidance issue two or three times. The non-traditional mortgage was issued once, and then a second version to cover subprime. Can you talk about what your area did and, you know, what were the developments that you saw that concerned you?
Okay.
Yep.
So, now, let me explain clearly when you're talking about, you know, the mortgage banking,
yes.
There are clear elements in the chain of mortgage banking of the business. There's, you know, underwriting, there's pipeline,
yep.
There's the structuring and sale of the securities. And, you know, as I explained, most of our efforts really were generated or focused around starting with the capital markets efforts. You know, what are the types of instruments and mortgage securities that were out there, and how are various pipelines in those securitization activities managed? And the reason, if you look at that, the reason why our focus was there is that the particular risks of pipeline and securitizations are managed within the bank, are managed in the asset liability management function. So, for example, banks that were originating mortgages and perhaps selling them out but keeping servicing, there's a large, you know, mortgage servicing asset on the books of institutions. Those are very difficult instruments to manage, to risk manage, given the optionality and the prepayments involved with that. And this is an issue that goes back not in the 2000s, but it goes back to the introduction of, you know, of pass-through mortgage securities. And I have to admit, I was one of the first risk managers at Freddie Mac in the mid-80s.
That was one thing we didn't do at the beginning, is kind of get a background. And I've forgotten, I remember you came from a risk management background, but just get a background.
I have a resume if you're...
That'd be good.
If you want, I'll just give you my resume.
That'd be great.
Right, okay.
That'd be great.
So I'm explaining, you know, what is our touch points? What was this section's touch points? What are supervisors' touch points from my perspective, from the market and liquidity risk? So when you were just bringing up the non-traditional mortgage, you know, issues, well, so those are clearly focused at underwriting, right? And so the non-traditional mortgage guidance and some of that particular guidance was conducted primarily by our credit risk area, right, under John Greenlee, and not necessarily by me.
That would have been Sabeth.
That's Sabeth Sadiq, right. And not to say that I was totally divorced from it. You know, I would comment on drafts of it, but it was primarily his responsibility, and he ended up having to go through all of the various comment periods, and I'm sure you know the war stories on that. But you see, our focus has always been on the capital markets elements, because even going back into the 1990s, when you had collateralized mortgage obligations, which at Freddie, I was on the team that structured the very first CMOs. So when I came to the Fed, you know, I knew about CMOs quite extensively, and I sort of taught Chairman Greenspan about them. So even in the 90s, when we had issues with regard to interest rate risk in banks, that was a clear focus, and that kind of kept that focus going forward. Getting closer. So we had throughout the system, we have developed various affinity groups, specialty, you know, subject matter expertise groups, where we would have specialists from each reserve bank who was in charge of being the specialist at that reserve bank, making sure that the staff was appropriately trained, that policies were being implemented appropriately. And we would coordinate various affinity groups to achieve our goal of trying to enhance consistency. And we had affinity groups in the trading area, in the treasury area, or asset liability management, interest rate risk. And we began developing mortgage affinity groups in mortgage servicing which were, because mortgage servicing was primarily focused at just a few large institutions, that affinity group was not perhaps as large as some of the others. So you're getting back to the question of what was our view regarding mortgage banking prior to the crisis or whatever. In 2003 and 2004, as part of our oversight of mortgage banking, whatever, we became aware of the fact of the need for, first of all, we became aware of the fact, this is primarily in 2004, we knew that there was a lot of mortgage origination business going on out in the market at the time. If you recall, there was a effort to raise interest rates by the board here. The rates were increasing. At that time, looking forward, we looked at the infrastructures that not only the banks, but a lot of the mortgage brokers had out there. They had hired a lot of people to do a lot of underwriting, whatever. We were expecting a significant number of layoffs from the banks and the brokers in response to the rise in rates, because that business.
That started in what, May of 2004?
I forget. Yeah, whenever that was. I kind of want to think it was maybe in the spring, but yeah, early in the spring. But anyway, we recognized that we weren't seeing the drop in volume in mortgage underwritings that we thought.
Yeah.
Also, I think I want to say in 2003, maybe it was ABN, or there was a number of institutions that ran into problems with Ginny Mae mobile home underwriting. And we started to see the creeping issues around underwriting, the no docs, the low docs, and all of the alt A's and everything. And we looked around the Federal Reserve System, and we said, that, once again, this is from a mortgage banking standpoint, not from a credit underwriting standpoint. But we looked around and we said, we need more staff system-wide to address many of these issues. We joined with the FDIC and the OCC, who did similar reviews and felt that there was a need for expanded examiner resources at all the agencies. In 2004, we held a 5-day mortgage banking specialist conference primarily devoted to train at least 30 people for each organization in mortgage banking issues and underwriting issues. At the time, we brought in the GSEs, the country, all of the underwriters to understand what the underwriting criteria were under no docs, low doc, to make sure that we had our people aware of this. So we identified these issues. We were making concerted efforts to do this.
Mr. Fassett, if I could interrupt you at some point.
Yeah, sure.
I hate to stop you. This is great.
Very interesting.
But you mentioned earlier about broker infrastructure. How much of that training was focused on trying to understand better that sort of non-bank? By broker, I mean, non-bank mortgage brokers. And how much of that was, kind of focused on that?
In all honesty, there was not a specific supervisory focus on that. But in order to understand the markets, you have to be aware of many of the players, not only banks. I mean, granted, we were very focused on the safety and soundness of the banks that we supervise. But in order to understand the business in which they're working, I would send my staff out to conferences. I would speak at conferences, and when you're at these conferences, you go to them, and the other mortgage brokers are there. So it wasn't a concerted effort to go out and find out what are the non-bank brokers doing. It was at the osmosis of understanding the industry, understanding the dynamics, knowing who the players were, who were the large originators. I mean, we were focused on the different segments of the pipeline.
Because they're the banks, I guess, vendors.
And
what about infrastructure? You mentioned that. What are you thinking there that you guys were noticing that?
Well, when I say infrastructure, I just mean, you know, the number of people, you know, the number of loan originators that, that were out there, the volume of, you know, non-regulated brokers. I mean, you could, I mean, you could just see if you just looked at the industry at the time and you laid out who's doing the business, where is it going, where are the banks, you know, who are the issuers on this side, and who are we supervising, and where are they getting their product? It's just a natural process of evaluation and of oversight.
So brokers themselves didn't need any funding because they're just brokers in the process.
Right.
And they're working with maybe other mortgage originators that might not be banks, but they might have funding concerns,
right.
Challenges.
Right, right.
And I guess, I guess you call those finance companies on the Fed Z1?
You got me there. Yeah. You got me there. I don't know. Yeah. When it gets to specific
information. But those are people who also were at these conferences? And
yeah. I mean, you know, there's all these stories in the paper, right? I'm not telling you anything about, you know, the conferences in, you know, Arizona or, you know, Florida or whatever were attended by 5,000 people, right? And you would go and you're there. And how, with all the vendors selling their wares, you take a look. But that's just a... It's a small element. You know, we also were reading the rag, for lack of a better term, the newsletters, whatever. And if my staff are staying on top of what's going on in the markets, we have some vision of the overall dynamics. I'm not saying that we knew, you know, I don't think anyone knew, you know, ultimately what the crisis was going to lead to. But I do know that we were very focused on making sure that we had a good cadre of people who could address mortgage banking, from the valuation of mortgage servicing rights to the recognition that if banks had securitization programs and they were purchasing loans from, you know, independent parties, that they had the underwriting criteria and supposedly the audit staff in place to manage some of this stuff. I mean, I'm not saying that we actually, you know, we did it. We tried to do it as best we could. Yeah. Is what I can say. And that is, we tried to train these folks. And I guess I would say that to a large extent, in looking back, and if you look at where the subprime mortgages really surfaced, you see that not a lot of banks were actually holding them in portfolio. You know, they didn't want the no doc loan. They didn't want this. And, you know, I would like to say that it was the examiners who did it, but I also believe it was probably some of the bankers didn't want to hold it. You know,
they might have been funding the inventory of some of the originators of these banks.
That's right. And I guess I have to admit, there was a thought process that went along that was basically, you're originating it, you're selling it out into the market. You know, as long as you're not holding the whole loans on a held-to-maturity basis, I think, okay, it was being pushed out to investors who knew or should have known or should have been doing the due diligence to understand what they were buying. Now, the other thing that we focused on at the time was the fact that some banks would buy the actual securities. Once the mortgages went through the pipeline and they were securitized, then there clearly was a focus on what the banks were holding in their investment portfolios. And we did try as best we could to make sure that our examiners could understand the structures that were being held by banks. But here again, I think we, as many other people, got waylaid by the rating agencies. I mean, that's one major element of the Dodd-Frank bill that's been identified. And I think you guys, I don't know if you've already done your hearings on that. But
yeah, that's one thing we're charged with looking at.
So, So, I mean, I think there's that element. There is the element of then what was going on in some of the securitization in the trading portfolios of the larger institutions and things like that. Let me just end my story on the training. I have to admit, though, that probably within a year after we had this conference, all of the agencies found out that at least half, if not 75%, of the people we had trained were subsequently hired by the industry.
Mm.
Okay. So, I mean, that's a constant, you know, challenge by regulators, and that is you have a recognition that there's got to be a constant pipeline of training. So and maybe I'll stop there and let you ask. Maybe I'm doing too much talking and I should just answer questions.
No, it's great. No. Okay. Good flow of thoughts. Can we go back, and I didn't realize we get to go into this as much, but here's where I have to be careful talking to myself. We have documents with the FCSC that talked, that were provided and talked about some of the financial holding companies' strategies in regards to mortgage origination. And to a T, in the 2006 timeframe, 2005-2006, the vision was to be a fully integrated mortgage operation warehouse that ultimately generated all these fees through securitization, and then pretty much 2006 to also be a large CDO originator as well. What were you seeing, and what was the involvement of your staff? Particularly, the Fed has holding company supervision. How did the program work in regards to that large growth area in those institutions? I guess, how did the RAP documents, the supervisory plans, were they focused on that? Were they concerned about that in terms of inherent risk and mitigants? It's a hard question, too.
It's really one of memory and it's one of sequencing, too. And then the issue you have to remember is that we were, as for lack of a better term, maybe if you view it as like maybe corporate headquarters, we had broad oversight here at the board and not necessarily as much hands-on supervisory process, but. So our primary involvement was to the extent that we had interactions with the team members from a training and education standpoint, and then also through the LFIT management group. Now, the LFIT management group did have a process of attempting to identify risks. They start off with these perspectives on risk documents, which you've seen. Also, within the normal operating process of that management group, every spring, late spring, right before the individual teams kicked into the development of their supervisory plan for the next year, there were held, and I want to say beginning in 2004, there were overall meeting of the LFI group in which subject matter experts, the credit area, the market and liquidity risk area, and the operational risk areas at the board and at the New York Fed and system-wide would make coordinated presentations of what the particular risks from a top-down overall standpoint had been identified, and making recommendations as to what particular business lines and what particular functions should merited supervisory review in the coming year. In other words, where they were in a resource planning mode, Where are we going to put our resources? I think at the time, I should have gone back and looked at all of them, but I know 2004, 2005, 2006, I've got presentations to that, risk presentations, this risk committee meeting. I would think that at least on one of those, prior to the crisis, mortgage banking had shown up as a topic to be pursued. Other topics that showed up in those reports, those recommendations of where resources should be, was the review of market risk management. And that would be a broad topic that included not only assessment of the capital models that were being used, but also the internal controls, all of the elements surrounding market risk management. And then even in some cases, we would identify certain areas, certain product lines that needed special attention. For example, one year I know there was not only market risk, but then within market risk, we needed to take a better look at commodities, commodity businesses, things like that. So there were processes where certain risks were identified to the LFI management group. The LFI management group was charged with identifying priorities, allocating resources. They took a risk-focused approach, and maybe this is one of the issues surrounding a risk-focused approach, is, prior to the crisis, market risk exposure seemed to be somewhat small. Mortgage banking issues, except perhaps around the potential volatility of MSRs, seemed to be small, low. This is another major issue, and I don't know if we don't need to get into it, is liquidity. The management of liquidity at organizations. Liquidity, the system was just flush with liquidity, and it was very, very hard to get people to focus on liquidity issues. I think as some of us knew before the crisis, I'm going back to 2003, 2004, I made speeches where it's basically saying I didn't know what the next crisis would be, but I know that a key contributing factor was going to be liquidity risk. Liquidity risk management and liquidity risk is not a risk in and of itself. It's consequential. It only arises when another risk manifests itself. But then when another risk manifests itself, liquidity risk management, basic liquidity mismatches, exaggerate and multiply the potential impacts.
Well, what were kind you of like leverage. When you identified liquidity risk as a likely critical part of the next problem?
Oh, just the some of the basic mismatches that were occurring. Maturity mismatches, short-term funding. And that's was not hard to see. I mean, that's...
You mean if you fund a long-term security with a short-term repo or...
Yes,
some other?
Right. Now, there were, the thing about it is that there were a lot of... intersecting, or there was a confluence of a number of elements, in this whole area of liquidity. In one sense, we had supervisors very focused on hedge funds and counterparty credit risk, and we did a major paper. David Lynch and my staff and I did a major paper on hedge funds for a board meeting in 2006. Where we went through and defined prime brokerage and identified certain margining issues, and the real issue there was hedge funds were taking leverage through various short-term secured lending transactions through repos and reverse repos, and not only repos, but other securities lending issues, right? So that was one confluence of saying, yes, there's a significant number.
So it was the maturity mismatch that had you alarmed or concerned, right?
And then you can also go back to the FDIC has always been very concerned about liquidity mismanagement and brokered CDs. You know, it's nothing new to the banking industry. But we saw a lot more reliance on banks on shorter-term funds. And a lot of that had to do with the shape of the yield curve and the impact, you know, of that shape on the margins, the net interest margins of the banking organizations. So we had that. And then at the same time, it was really very interesting. You know, this is where, at least in the market and liquidity risk areas, the agencies were pretty well coordinated. We seemed to coordinate pretty well there, because at the same time we were doing this mortgage banking training, we had also gone around and identified gaps in the quality of our examiner supervision of liquidity risk. And arising from that, board staff, Federal Reserve staff, we had developed a 80-page treatise guidance on liquidity risk management that we developed in late 2004, early 2005. We gave it to the other agencies to see if they wanted to issue it on an independent, you know, on a joint basis, on an interagency basis. It was a little too long for them. It was a training. It had a lot of training material as well as basic principles. And there was a decision at the FFIEC not to move forward on developing any interagency guidance on liquidity. And I think that happened in early 2006. I want to say March or February of 2006, the FFIEC, because of all of any number of issues facing the industry at the time and the fact that there was plenty of liquidity in the system, there didn't seem to be a need to issue liquidity guidance. The Federal Reserve, what we did though, is we took our enhanced guidance and we did insert it in our trading and capital markets activities manual in 2006, and we tried to push it out to our examiners as best we could. But it becomes difficult when you don't have an interagency. Let me end that story. And so then the question, so where did a lot of that guidance that we issued, that we put in our manuals for our examiners in 2006 end up? Where did it go? Well, in 2007, as the Basel Committee started looking at liquidity and wanted to look at issuing some guidance on liquidity, we ended up taking much of our guidance that we had in our manual and reduced it, redrafted it, and submitted it to the Basel Committee, which was then adopted by the Basel Committee in 2008. And so you can go back through and you can match a 2006 version of our liquidity guidance, yes, and you'll see the exact same paragraphs in the international guidance. And then given that issuance in 2008, then it came down to finally the USA agencies validating and signing on to the international liquidity guidance, and so that was the genesis of the issuance that we had earlier this year.
Did you look at other elements about the short-term funding issue, whether it's haircuts or whether it was the liquidity of the instruments used to collateralize the short-term loans, or did you look at how the role of tri-party agency banks, clearing banks in this market, or did you look at how transparent was the trading activity in some of these?
Focus primarily on hedge funds. I mean, once again, coming through the PWG, was doing a lot of work. I'm sure you've already gone back and tracked all the work that the PWG was doing. all of the work that, that came out of the CRMPG group coming out of the LTCM over the years. We were very, very focused on that. We were very focused on how hedge funds were taking leverage. And as I mentioned, in 2006, David Lynch and I wrote a major paper for the board on how hedge funds take leverage, what were some of the issues. At the time, there were concerns with regard to the competition bidding down margins. There were issues with regard to some banks not charging initial margins to hedge fund customers. I mean, these were all thought, you know, these are documented. There was an issue that we identified, but then once again maybe got risk focused out given the environment. But we did raise some concerns that there was no initial margin going, or margining at all going between major institutions. And some no initial margins. But these were all counterparty credit risk issues. They were identified. There were a number of efforts that were underway to identify, you know, counterparty credit risk issues, management information system lapses and gaps in some certain institutions. There were also concerns. There was also recognition that many of the instruments in some trading portfolios were very difficult to value. As we found out, and in 2004, 2005, the New York Fed conducted a review of banks' valuation of instruments and didn't necessarily find anything
at the time.
Yeah, they looked at the process. Right, right.
It was 06.
Yeah, I want to say 2005.
Can we go back to some of the structuring and any elements since you first structured CMOs and Freddie Mac? There were a lot of innovations in the market, and
right.
You talked about product innovations in the and volume increases in the 2003-2004. It's a huge revival in history. Just mortgage underwriting itself. Was there a focus on the structure of the transactions, that there was big growth in the private label stuff during that time?
Right. We did have a number of folks. We had a small securitization affinity group that from time to time would get together and go through some of the prospectuses just to understand what some of the new twists were. We weren't reviewing every instrument or everything that came out, but there was kind of a recognition, if you stayed up with the literature or whatever, there were certain new things that were coming out. And but I have to admit, at the time, there was not a lot of focus put on really identifying and understanding the structures. I think there was a maybe just from my perspective, I think there was a hope that there was an investor base out there that was reviewing, a knowledgeable investor base that was reviewing that there was some market discipline that ended up not being there.
So, like the shifts in this product, I mean, the product features themselves changed with RMBS, private label, moved to subprime, multi. The structure's changed with that. But then, I guess the next piece, and I kind of go back to looking at the identification of risk, was the CDO piece. And the presentations to boards of directors about, this is the new great thing, it's going to generate a lot of income. Did any of that, at that time, the income side of that, did any of that kind of flow to the LFI committee and then
into the supervisory plans, sort of this migration and innovation in the not only development of mortgages themselves and their structuring and the shift of product, but also, you know, the CDO was sort of structuring.
I mean, following the money is the basic, is a basic fundamental tactic that, examiners should follow. This is one area that I guess I would have to say is we were aware of the of this area as an income source, but it wasn't sufficient enough to obviously it wasn't sufficient enough to put it up on the list of the LFI management group at the time. It was our internal processes. It's our internal processes, assessments, whatever. We knew about the CDOs and we were concerned about the CDOs. But the question was, well, are the banks holding any of the residual tranches? Well, no, they weren't. They were selling them out. What were they holding? They were holding the super seniors. the ones that they couldn't sell because they were too high quality. No one, because there wasn't enough spread for, an institutional investor. So I think that there was that, and so there was maybe this false sense of comfort that the structures and the waterfalls and maybe obviously a lack of appreciation of any potential fraud that might have existed in the underwriting or whatever.
When they tried to offload some of the super senior tranches into these single seller unconsolidated SPVs, I think they're called SIBs or condos.
Oh, they're SIBs, right.
Yeah. What kind of reach did you have into examining and monitoring that activity?
Once again, please keep my role in context here, and that it's from a broad overview and not at the individual institutions going in and looking at that. I have to admit, on the SIBs, at least I myself, we were aware of them. I think there was a feeling that they were legally separate entities. That the risk was out of the bank, and we were very we're concerned about the safety and soundness of individual banks, and maybe we weren't as concerned about those investors in the SIBs. Now, that was not our mandate before me. It is now from a systemic risk standpoint.
I guess they're going to change the capital charge for that. That would be one way, I guess, to reduce.
Well, right, and even then, obviously the key link there was a word with liquidity puts, right, and liquidity commitments.
Right.
And I think there were capital charges on those. They'll be increased enough, but I would go back and say. My personal opinion is that yes, where capital charges help, I don't think capital arbitrage or whatever was the primary motivation for banking organizations to be doing this. I mean, there was just a lot of income generated through this, and it was a sufficient enough income to pay for the capital cost, to pay the capital charges. And when you actually looked at the risks, as the risks were being managed, thought that that amount of capital was sufficient.
Well, I never thought of it as a capital arbitrage. I always thought of it as a way of generating, compared to keeping it all on your balance sheet, you generated by and large the same amount of income, but without having to kind of lower your return on assets. Right? It was a fairly, if you did it on balance sheet, it's going to really swell your balance sheet up with a fairly kind of some of them were low return in the sense you had low yielding super senior tranches that you were funding by issuing low cost short term paper, but then doing an interest rate swap because you didn't want to hold an interest rate risk. And after you did that, the yield was not too much, but if you leverage it up, it was just fine because after all, these were low risk securities. Yeah, but it would make your balance sheet look huge if it was all done on balance sheet. And then for each individual dollar of assets, then the return wouldn't be so great. So you move it off balance sheet, your reported assets are smaller, but you still get the same income through your fees and other.
Yeah. How,
so it seemed like it was a capital arbitrage, but it was just more of a accounting way to. It seemed to me a way to make it look like the firm was kind of more profitable.
It's really how we want to perceive it. If you look at it, is they're two different products, or they're two different businesses. One way to look at it. One is if you're in the buy and hold businesses, then you're trying to make money off of the spread between your funding costs and your asset, and that's over a longer period of time. But with the securitization, that's a transaction business run the capital markets, since we have evolved capital markets, allow that business. And basically what all that business does, I mean, you're right, one way to view it is that given mark-to-market accounting, you can compress the realization of earnings of a buy and hold strategy to a point in time to a transaction.
Or in this case, you get the way I see it, earnings, but without having to report it as a larger amount of assets, so your return on assets goes up.
Right.
From an accounting reporting point of view.
Yeah, I think that...
Because you've already made your capitalized profit through the securitization process. That's done. And now it's a question of what are we going to do with these super senior tranches that are hard to sell because they're so low yield. And they're not kind of juicy enough, and so one way is to figure out a cheap place to park them and still,
kind of leverage them up.
Right.
However you want to look at it. I guess I was just looking at it as the fact is that a lot of these senior tranches were the leftovers, the residuals, whatever, the high quality residuals that were left over, and they had to be put somewhere, and rather than. And so what you were doing is you were just finding other people to finance them for you.
But the real money
was in the transactions. The real money was conducting the transactions, was extracting the value added that came through the origination, the pipeline, the securitization, and the structuring, being able to pull out from your structure. AAA down to the structures, pulling that value out.
Can I ask you a slight tangential question, just because you seem to be so broadly knowledgeable of this? When the banks were doing the securitization, where did they hold some of the, if you will, the pipeline or warehouse risk? Was that all done on balance sheet, and if so, was it in their trading book, or was some of it done off balance sheet through other special purpose entities that they used to kind of park it temporarily and fund it separately through that SPE instead of on the balance sheet?
The answer is yes.
They did all that.
No, and it really depended upon what institution you were looking at, right? So if you were a investment bank, your cost of funds were significantly higher than a bank, right? Because you couldn't go out and get insured deposits and things like that. So if you were an investment bank, this is my recollection. Someone could come in and say I'm wrong. Okay? You could bring in a guy from Goldman and say he's got it all wrong. Yeah. But my recollection, it would be that I think some of the investment banks had various structured vehicles in which they could, as they were buying them in, they could park it and get secured funding to finance that pipeline. And because investment banks throw everything in the trading account, they mark everything to market, then yes, that's in the trading account. I think some other institutions would run their pipeline as, you know, loans available for sale through the banking book. And they may not have, although they were, you know, I don't know the rule, the accounting treatment. I forget the accounting treatment for loans held for sale. But I still don't think they were fair value. Okay, good. See, I could look to the examiner.
Yeah, it's not for trading. It's available for sale.
Right,
that's right.
Right.
It's not called a maturity either. So there's, I forget the intermediate.
The key here is whether it's an investment or a loan, right? And the investments clearly are fair value, but the loans aren't. So you could then run those through and extract the value when you sold them.
One of the things, out on the public website, there are like 20 things we're told to investigate. So if you want to read that. But one of these is sort of capital arbitrage, which might be a dirty word, but like in 2007, there's a Susan Baez speech where she talks about things that are in the trading book, well beyond what the BIS may have contemplated in 1996. And, you know, one is mortgages, both commercial and residential. So those are valued under a VAR framework. Your opinion about, a lot of our financial holding companies played investment bank during that time frame,
right.
And we're doing that business in a big way. What is your view around the VAR models that we've used? You talked about a New York study, didn't find real problems.
That was on valuations.
On
valuations, right.
Do you think
so? The VAR models, going back, I mean, once again, I said, you know, maybe I'm part of the blame here, but I was on the market, on the models task force of the Basel group in the 90s that came out with the VAR approach to the market risk amendment. At the time, you know, that when that rule came out, there was a lot of guidance around that saying VAR is not the be-all to end-all. You have to have stress testing. You have to have other limits around it. At the time, traded credit risk was not very big. Okay. As a matter of fact, when we were debating value at risk and we were debating the various parameters around it, the quarterly update of the information, the look-back period in which you're doing it, whether to use value at risk, whether to use, you know, the 99th percentile, whatever, we did throw around proposals for, well, why don't we just specify a stress test? Because that's all VAR really is a stress. Why don't we be brave enough to step up and do it? Kind of like we did last year, ultimately coming out of the crisis. But, you know, VAR was a stress test, but what we allowed a lot of parameters to be codified and so that the banks could run it. So I think that there was recognition of the inadequacy of some of the VAR models. There was a hope that the banks had counterbalancing controls, that there was more stress testing being done than actually was, that there were other controls that were being used.
What other controls? Were people doing scenario analysis or some other?
Well, let's put it this way. You know, stress testing never really got to a point where it should have been. And so that's where you're seeing things go down. But there were some other, I mean, there were some banks internally that may have used, you know, in a value at risk context, that may have used expected shortfall. I don't know if you know what that is, but that instead of taking the 99th percentile, you take the entire tail, and people take the average of the entire tail distribution. Or there were some there were some banks that were
internal. There was also trying to say, take how much of it we'd have to lose to be insolvent, and ask what's the probability of that occurring. It's kind of a reverse.
The reverse stress testing, whatever. Reverse stress testing has always been kind of difficult because, at least for bankers, to try to get their hands around just exactly what would it take me to fail without having the data. You have to remember before the crisis, there were no data points. And that was especially a key issue around the trade and credit. But, I mean, I guess going back to Tobias' speech, whatever, I think there was a recognition that more and more illiquid instruments were getting into the, or hard to value. I wouldn't say necessarily, I mean, just hard to value, because even corporate bonds, even plain vanilla corporate bonds, don't trade. They don't all have market. We all know that they're matrix priced. And so you had a matrix pricing, you know, regime just carry over to, you know, it was kind of a natural reaction. But I guess I would say that it was known that the market risk amendment and the capital rules needed to be changed back when we were looking at Basel II. And that was 2003, 2004. And if you go back and look at, there was a working group of the Basel Committee established to revise the trading account capital treatment. Began in 2004, I think. I'm pretty sure it's 2004. They still haven't implemented the rule that they proposed. I mean, I think that's a travesty. I have not been involved in that. Was not able to participate in that. But, you know, David Lynch and I, we interviewed David Lynch yesterday. When David Lynch was at the SEC in 2004, we developed the counterparty credit risk approach for Basel II in 8 months and sunsetted our group and moved on. Now, people can go back and say what we did needed to be revised, but we established our goals and they wanted a loan equivalent, put it into the AIRB model. We did that. We posited all of the problems that the, you know, there's correlation between major counterparties, especially in that this wouldn't capture it, but neither does the standard correlation assumption in the AIRB model. I might be rambling. I don't need to go too far here. But I do think that there was recognition, and there has been recognition, that the market risk amendment needed to be fixed a long time ago. And it's just that, for some reason, and I don't know if it's, I don't know what it is, it hasn't been able to get pushed forward.
Good kind of summary of all these elements. One of the things that you mentioned, Jim, was that and it's true, all the guidance says you got to have superior risk management. Examiners need to be aware of the risk. This is true for asset-backed commercial paper guidance, credit derivative transaction guidance.
And going way back, right?
Yeah, it all talks about the risk management of firms. So in some of our interviews, and I'm walking that fine line, I can't talk to myself, I'm not an examiner, I'm this rate. In some of our, within the Commission's work, this VAR modeling and the activities of the firm were not, it was seen as good, seen as strong. And one thing you mentioned was the stress overlays. Things you can model, you set parameters around. For other firms, not so good. You mentioned quarterly updates.
Oh, you mean the actual the actual conduct of the VAR method. Okay, yes. There's two issues around VAR, right? One was that I think even going up through senior management teams and boards of directors, everyone placed too much emphasis on one number. I think many of the banks will admit that and have admitted it in the senior supervisors. But then it's okay. So now you're getting to a point where, yeah, there are, you know, banks are different. Some are better. Some are better than others. And just as we're seeing today, some banks make more money than others. Some have a different culture, whatever. I think one of the issues comes down to is once again, this is personal. It's not the fact that all banks need to be doing best practice. question is, are all banks following sound practice? If we made all banks do everything the same, we'd take away innovation and probably remuneration for those institutions that are good risk managers.
Yeah.
This is assuming you're going to let banks fail or whatever, but in the new environment, I think this was kind of where we were, at least this is where I was living at the time, and that is, as long as there can be differences, as long as they're following sound approaches. Now, and then the question becomes, well, what's sound? And clearly, looking back, there were some organizations that may not have had as robust a modeling process or models or information structure, ability to pull all the information from different legacy systems together.
So that
did indeed exist.
In some instances in the interviews, the communication element. Like you say, everybody can't be best practice, but examiners see this stuff and they, I saw this here, I don't see it here, and they have to make that sort of sound judgment. On the flip side, some examiners saw some really bad practice and recognized it, albeit maybe late in the process, but the communication process didn't get to the other guys, hey, you realize they're doing liquidity puts and they don't buy them? Do you think there was, as things started to blow up, was there a communication process up to the LFI and out to these capital markets experts? I mean, in some of our interviews, some of these experts, not necessarily Fed, were sort of unaware.
So this would be to the extent that you know, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I can only talk in broad generalities on this. There are any number of times in my 20 years here at the Fed, there probably a week doesn't go by where an examiner hasn't seen something, brought it to the attention, and perhaps in some cases the issue is either, sometimes it's remediated, sometimes it's weighed with a number of other factors. So clearly, I may have a market, this is just a description, a theoretical description, I may have a market risk manager who feels that he's identified a really key issue, and it's really very important, but if I'm the CPC or if I'm the head of the LFI, I have all these other very significant credit underwriting issues over here, and I have these operational risk issues and these fiduciary issues and some of these market risk issues, and now I'm looking to prioritize. And if I'm going to go in and ask for remediation and ask for the bank to allocate resources, what to me as the CPC or someone who has to make the call, where do I make that call? And so I can see where you can oftentimes get issues where people are saying, we identified this, people didn't do anything, and I would come back to this is probably a result of the process, a result of the maybe risk-focusing aspect of it, and an effort to deal with limited resources of trying to identify priorities. Now, whether you have a process established to appropriately identify those, and the people around to do that, I don't know if that answers your question, but it's kind of my take on it, and that is, yes, there's always going to be some people that feel that they've identified things that they weren't taking care of. But I think on the communication standpoint, I think that there is there are silos in any organization, in any bank, in any corporation, any government agency, any CPC team or whatever.
That's right.
So I think those were always just difficult areas to overcome. One thing that we did try to do is through our various affinity groups and in coordinating with the coordinators, the market liquidity risk coordinators in the LFI, is try to send out messages to them or have them identify issues to bring to the group and get that. But that's not a definitive communication mechanism.
One thing I'm really interested in, I think Randall and the commission is well of, is there was a tipping point, and then you go into crisis mode. In your memory, kind of what was that? Was it the first wave of ratings or whatever? And then kind of your area, how did supervision change? Obviously, it changed from, well, we're going to wait until the spring to do a conference, into more of a crisis mode. So kind of what was the tipping point, and how did the efforts of your staff and even reaching down into the CPC SMEs, what did it look like in crisis mode?
And looking back, well, clearly, you had Bear Stearns, you had the Bear Stearns hedge funds, started to create some concern. Many of the efforts, beginning in 2006, 2005, 2006, in bank supervision, we implemented different management and reporting structures through a reorganization. At the same time, the LFI management process was strengthened and whatever. That led to the fact that a number of the crises, events, whatever, were primarily handled within that LFI process and primarily handled by the senior leadership team of the division. Unlike any other crisis that has occurred since 1991 when I joined the Fed, we did not necessarily have coordinated war rooms or whatever. This was pretty much handled through the senior leadership team at BS&R. So, to a large extent, me and my staff, we weren't as involved in any number of the issues. So we weren't involved in the AIGs and the. My staff was asked to help OFAO to go in and help review Freddie and Fannie right before the conservatorship, but that's primarily our key involvement. I'm sorry, that's not much of an answer, but it was, we particularly weren't that involved in many of the decisions and all of the things that are going on.
And honestly, it's kind of a theme in the discussions that we have. It's a question, why is communication what it was. Were you guys asked to do any, I've got to separate what I know and what, but just your perspective, like CDS spread monitoring. During that time frame, as the LFI's doing this, we're still monitoring CDS spreads.
I have to admit, in the credit areas, whatever, even before the crisis, yes, there was a significant effort, and I forget in what context it was, but especially in the LFI context, but in other contexts too, with our economist colleagues, research colleagues, and that is the use of public information as warning signals. And so, as the CDS market developed, and there's a recognition of the potential value in spreads. We did that. We looked at, we just followed stock prices, just followed the KMB, the EDFs, or whatever could come out. But as we've all seen, those are not predictive. Those are consequential indicators. So what happened, what I do know what happened during the crisis was that, you know, yes, after Bear Stearns hedge funds went down, you know, the finance markets started to tighten. Spreads started to widen for some financial institutions. As those spreads started tightening, I know the New York Fed stepped in and started monitoring liquidity positions on an ongoing basis for all the large institutions. And kicked into that, into a monitoring mode. But if you're asking, and you're right, we're still looking at CDS spreads and KMV, EDFs, and whatever, but I'm still wondering why we continue to look at them, because the research has shown they don't.
And I think the purpose of the examination is, in some sense, you have non-public information that should help you better anticipate problems than the markets presumably have only public information.
Oh, right.
And so looking at public information is important, but hardly sufficient. And so one of the things I was thinking of when I was listening to your description of how you're conducting the supervision of the banks is that a lot of it seems to really be, as you said, focused on our banks. And what I'm not hearing so far...
It was.
And that was indeed your duty, but from a stabilization supervision point of view, what am I hearing is the following two things. One is that you're not looking too much into the particular markets that were key to these particularly large banks interacting with another. Now, you're not looking into the repo markets, how repos traded. You might not have talked to the interdealer brokers in the repo market to know about how it's traded, or the haircut issues, or transparency issues of the trading. Talk to maybe the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation about how some of that credit risk in the repo market is conducted. You got into the OTC derivatives markets, but sort of through the hedge fund issue.
Yeah.
But not directly as a key dimension to the interbank connectedness of these large firms. So each individual firm might be managing its own risk pretty well, but one is that you don't really know the full dimension of that risk without knowing whether that market has got resilient structures or more fragile structures. And then the other dimension of my question, I'm sorry for going on, but
I've been waiting
a long time, and this has been a developing question as I've been really thoughtfully listening to your excellent exposition of this process. The other dimension I haven't heard yet is, you know, the bank examiners, I don't know what a CPC is, but
Central point of contact.
Is it what?
Central point of contact.
Okay, so yeah, that's the guy on top of the team at the bank. Okay. And I'm sure there's some less flattering other uses of the term. But are those guys compiling information across firms? Apparently that's what this LFIG was designed to do in part. But did it actually do things like, well, you know, it's sort of like if one bank's got a large position in something, that's one thing. But if five banks have 95% of all the positions in one thing, that's also an important realization. So in other words, what you need to not only look, it seems to me like what you'd want to be able to factor in is an analysis of the dependability of these key markets through which they work with one another, and to see if there's any accumulation of exposures in these few key firms that might have a systemic implication that might be reasonably well managed at the individual level. And here I'm just thinking of even the lessons we've learned from the quant quake. When you look at how all these well-managed quant hedge funds blew up, it wasn't that they did anything wrong internally. But what happened was they got their credit lines cut all at the same time for losses somebody else took. And when they were forced to unwind because someone else created a demand for credit, they only realized then that, oh, I'm not the only quant fund making this trade. And they all were in a crowded investment space and tried to unwind at once. And that caused a severe problem for the whole market. And so that's just by way of metaphor. of if you're not adding up across key firms, and then you're not, and in this case, you know, the hedge funds can't know how crowded their space is. It's not public information. But a supervisor would know that, and at least now they would know that under Dodd-Frank. And so, anyway, I was just trying to ask what you'd been thinking about in terms of those dimensions of the supervisory challenge facing, you know, a bank supervisor.
Well, you know, the thing about it is there's a lot of changes going on underway, and so a lot of these things are being addressed. But I'd go back and, I mean, you're hitting on a number of concepts where there are a number of different answers or treatments or observations that people made about how things were done in the past. And I'll just tick off just a few. So, to a certain extent, may I work from the bottom up over some of the last comments you made, work up to some of the first ones you made. So, yeah, one of the keys here is what you're talking about is really a need to take a systemic approach and look across the institutions, whatever. Two things occur to me then, and here I'm thinking back to what the frame of mind was before the crisis.
Right.
Okay. So one is a concern with regard to burden on the institutions. Mm-hmm. How much burden do we want to place? The other was we were in a mode of principle-based supervision. Okay? There was an expectation that firms were to be managing their risk, okay, and it wasn't for us to tell them how to do it or what to do it. I think there was a recognition that, I mean, counterparty credit risk was very important because we were focused on hedge funds. And so we were asking banks, give me the list of your top 20 counterparty exposures. When we saw what it was, well, their top 20 largest exposures were to other institutions, you know, other banks. So we'd have to go down and say, no, that's not what we really want, because we know Citi and JPMC, they're doing transactions all day. I don't think that there was an appetite to go in down that through and say, okay, now we want to know what your commodity, you know, what your oil and gas exposure is between Citi, because that's really what, that's kind of what you're talking about, and that's where are you going to be able to find the crowded trades? And it's easy to sit down and conceptually think about it, but when you really try to sit down and try to do it, you've got to start actually specifying, okay, where are we seeing it? Are we talking about a contract level? Are we just talking about broad trends? Are we talking about, no, we're interested in the, you know, CDS on IBM, you know? There's a lot of decisions when you try to take concepts and bring them down, and it involves a lot of burden. And unfortunately, the banks are getting hit with it, because I think increasingly there's a lot more of this analysis going on about what are the cross exposures. But at the time, here again, I'm thinking back at the time, there was, you know, there was this concern. There was the other concern. Just, you know, let me. The other concern here, or the other issue was, you're right, we weren't taking a broad view of interrelationships. Okay, and it wasn't as if no one wasn't out there crying that we have to look at crowded trades. You know, in the hedge fund space, you know, issue, everyone was saying, oh, there could be a lot of crowded trades out there. What was our response at the time? Our response of our chairman and, you know, some of our senior policymakers was, well, wait a minute, we have, in some of the banks, each individual bank has risk management processes in place to protect itself. So what one could say, why care about everyone else? Because there was a thought that, well, if there's one institution that's going to go down, let it go down. I don't think we were thinking in the context of a systemic meltdown in of the proportions that we were thinking, because I just, think that it was, people couldn't conceive the fact that we were going to get credit deterioration in one product line that rivaled, you know, the Depression. So you're right, there's a, you know, maybe a false sense of confidence, whatever, but there was also, there were also these key expectations around that. And then one last point on the tri-party market. You know, we didn't, it is interesting that the some of the issues around tri-party just came to the fore with the Bear Stearns hedge funds and things like that. And so that I've scratched my head a number of times saying, well, how could we have found this? I mean, we did know that margins in securities funding transactions and repos, whatever, always get squeezed by competition. I mean, it's a constant, that's what happens with the bubble, with bubbles in this cycle, right? They constantly get squeezed, and then something happens like LTCM or whatever, and it goes out. But so we were aware, the question was, did the leadership, did the people in leadership who had the ability to go in and say, to establish some type of margin rules, say, wait, things are a little bit crazy here, you're allowing, you've got illiquid instruments that you're charging 10% on, that's too much. So I don't think that there was a will to do that. And then second of all, how would we have found that the tri-party repo market? I've been scratching my head and thinking about that over the years, whatever. And the only way we would have done that is if we had implemented our liquidity, real strict liquidity requirements, liquidity risk management requirements. Because those liquidity risk management requirements would require institutions to evaluate their sources of funds, what the characteristics are of their lenders, and what would happen to them in a stress environment. I mean, if we had better imposed that particular guidance, then we would have had, at least had people thinking about it, and we might have uncovered it before the crisis. But here I come back to this risk focusing. But there was plenty of liquidity out there, so it was risk focused away. So, I mean, you wonder, so there's going to be the next crisis, and I don't know what it's going to be.
Right.
Okay, but the source is going to be overconfidence, yep, and ignoring something that seemed obvious.
Dodd-Frankville didn't address.
And so we're doing all this stuff to fix it. I can guarantee you it's not going to be on any of the things that we're fixing now.
Well, the Dodd-Frank didn't address it. It was not touched.
Well, I think one of the things, one of the hopes was that the liquidity standards that were being proposed by the Basel Committee would address some of these. I know I was very involved in developing the NSFR, the structural measure. And my goal in developing that was primarily to put a regulator of sorts on short-term funding margins, because that particular approach actually goes in and assigns certain margins at a minimum from a liquidity standpoint, not from a credit standpoint, from a liquidity standpoint. So we'll see where that particular measure goes, but.
Well, you mentioned about the burden on the firm for reporting buildup of exposures. I just wanted to maybe draw your attention to precedents that are already there in the U.S., the large trader reporting data by futures brokers, and people just sit in that market already do that daily. And also in the securities markets, there's already, I think it's 14F, if you own more than 5% of the outstanding shares or issuance, I think you're also required to report. So, and since most of your LFIG entities are actually already doing that, but on a slightly narrower basis, but under other statutory authorities. And so those, in those cases, those, they're already burying those birds that hadn't been doing it for a long time. So
to that extent, I mean, one could say that, you know, these are the OTC markets, and we, the Fed, and especially the New York Fed, identified that and started a lot of these infrastructure efforts, right? And so that's I'm assuming that's the reporting you're talking about.
Well, you did the OTC market with the credit derivatives. They went to improved operational risk management because they're concerned about the rather enormous time delays in confirming trades that people, you can't really sort of guide you doing good risk management if you don't really know that you actually have a trade on. So,
but I mean, I think there's increased trade reporting now across the OTC market, out of that effort, that merged or morphed or added to that, now a very thorough trade reporting system
with the help of DTCC's derivatives. So now you also have very prompt and much more thorough, which again came out initially the operational risk side of it. But anyway, that's also a from a notional amount point of view, that's a fairly small part of that market. But again, that is nonetheless an example of them apparently, you know, taking that what might be considered a burden and running with it, because what you find is that if you just build that into your back office operations, it's costless virtually. Because in some sense you're just CCing the depository institution what on the records that you yourself are likely to already be keeping.
Right.
So once you've got a standard format, then you just CC them on the email. And it's no more costly than that. But I just thought I would add that, because you're right, there's a limit to what you can burden the entity with. But I just wanted to compare it to its existing burdens. So I guess the hope was that then, in terms of their internal risk assessment efforts, that they themselves were looking into these markets, such as repo or securities lending, where haircuts, by the way, were negative going into the crisis. You actually got the haircut. If you were lending out the security, you didn't pay it. I think there was
a certain expectation that there were processes and procedures in place. And at the same time, once again, I'll just come back to there's an element of risk focusing, right? And that is, maybe there was not as a...
Yeah, you're right. There was a ton of liquidity, but there was, I guess in hindsight, maybe that had the effect of people overlooking the fragility of that abundant liquidity. And it was, I mean, certainly in terms of price, it was pretty low. but thanks for your answer. I just wanted to hear how you guys were thinking about that, because that was the, we've been, with Steve, you know, we talk a lot about the process and all that's very focused on the firm level. And so I'm just curious how they went about conceptualizing what's happening outside the bank when trying to assure
and we did and, I don't think I'm saying anything. I think you already know of the fact that we had a financial stability umbrella group here at the Fed that I think we started in, I want to say 2005, where it was senior staff. I think this was Chairman Bernanke. One of his first things that he, when he came on board, had asked for staff to form the Financial Stability Senior Management Group, and they made, I want to say semi-annual reports to the board in 2005 and 2006, and then maybe into 2007, and of course, and then the crisis hit. Everyone was doing systemic. So, I mean, I think there was an attempt to address some of those, you know, some issues. And so that shows you the extent and the of what we were able to do prior to that.
Right. So that sounds more like a kind of a research, senior policymakers, macro picture on the markets, but that wasn't exactly integrated in with the with the team on the ground. Yeah. I mean, so there was a
we tried to the extent that we could.
Right. Yeah, but
can I ask about? We've got some great quotes on that'll make it.
I hope
but
not for
no,
me.
No. We have to be very careful in that. But from others about like CDOs in particular. Total return swaps and CDOs, or some and trust preferred securities are just fair instruments. If examiners, and I think I know the answer, but examiners going in, I understand about risk focusing and capital markets structure in person. Is going in looking at a structuring process and a CEO process. Would they have had the skill set to put together the linkages between the way that a CEO was structured? Let's not go to CEO squares, but. Do you think the skill sets were there for this new type of instrument, if that had been a focus?
Well, I guess it's not. You have to ask yourself, what would you expect an examiner to do in going in and looking at these instruments? Why is he looking at them to begin with?
Right.
So the question becomes one of if they're in the trading portfolio, what is his key issue with regard to any instrument that's in there, and that is it being valued appropriately? And so he can go through the treasuries and he can go through the Ginnie Mae's, and he'll go right through the line and he'll see, okay, so he sees these CDOs. Now the question would be, what if he's looking at these CDOs, why is he looking at it? And it's his valuation. So then the question becomes, well, how is the bank valuing it? Does the bank understand it? And you know, these structures are very complex, that you actually have to go out to a company to buy. You know, just like with CMOs, you've got to buy the structure, you know. Got to buy the algorithm that shows you where the cash flow goes. So I don't know. I don't understand. I think in asking that question, you've got to ask yourself, what would the goal be? Now, I think we had a few examiners who could go in and understand the structure, but once again, I don't know. Generally, the examiners that we had going in looking at structures, yeah, were primarily the ones that were going into regional and small banks and looking at investment portfolios. Okay, because and this is where you get banks who buy something that they don't understand and don't do the due diligence. And there, I do think that it's always a challenge for us to have examiners with the capabilities of understanding the investments. That's why, at least in the interest rate risk and market risk area, the Federal Reserve and the OCC, for years, I want to say maybe 10 years, but it might be 7, whatever, we have access to a regional bank's, a regional broker's risk evaluation system that gives us access to a number of capabilities where our examiners can send in QSIPs and we can send them back market valuations. So I don't know how to... I'll tell you one thing, at least from a market review standpoint or from a market risk model review, when we go in and look at models, I firmly believe that our quants can go head toe-to-toe with any bank's quants. We have some really incredibly sharp people. I think we have a challenge in and having enough of them and having enough for different disciplines. But I think the teams that we've established and those capabilities are fine. But when you get to securitization, the actual securitization instruments that can get incredibly complex, that you really need a lot of sophisticated computer analysis around, I think we could use more, but what I come back to in what context doing the is it maybe spot checking to assess whether the bank's internal valuation processes are appropriate.
So we're getting close to the end.
I want to get in a couple of questions if I can.
Yes.
I've had the good luck to learn a lot recently, and I've heard a lot of discussions from the 100,000 foot level to ground level. But I'm also very interested in something I haven't heard, and that is, if you can, for instance, think back to the Bear Stearns weekend, and think back to that Monday coming to work after the Bear Stearns weekend, if you were here, if you were at work, but in your 20 years, was that a day like any others? What was the climate like? Were people, were there more meetings? Dave, actually, I'd be interested in anything you think on this. What was, in the wake of Bear Stearns, what was the climate like within the Fed?
You know, I mean, with the hedge funds or when Bear Stearns went down?
When Bear Stearns went down. Yes, when Bear Stearns went down. And then all of a sudden, people were mobilizing to think about Lehman and other things. What was the day like? Were people, I find it hard to imagine it was business as usual.
I can only come back to when I think about it. I think that yes, there was a lot of our staff. There was a lot of talk. There was a lot of discussion. I have to admit, my only role in the Bear Stearns was I was asked the Thursday before it went down. I was asked to call the SEC and ask them about what they thought about Bear Stearns and its capital position. And the SEC told me, don't worry, be happy. They've got plenty of capital. and luckily I wrote a suitably, you know, qualified email that said, the SEC says this, and then came in Monday, that next Monday. So I wasn't really that,
right.
I wasn't really involved. But was it, yes, it was that a significant issue? Yeah, that was a significant issue, but I wasn't necessarily involved.
Forgive me, I may have phrased it the wrong way. I'm not asking about your involvement in Bear Stearns. I'm kind of interested in what was the atmosphere like within the Fed as word circulated about Bear.
So he's the writer and looking for a little...
Yeah, I'm looking for a way, I'll put it another way. To readers of this book, this crisis is very personal. It's their 401ks that are down. And it's very important, I think, to add a dimension that people who are in and around the solutions to this crisis are human beings, too, doing things and interested in things. And because the Fed was so much at the center of this crisis, I would like to sort of suggest, after Bear Stearns, people came to work, conversations, was the tempo different? Were there more meetings?
Oh, yeah.
That's all I'm asking.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it was the Federal Reserve. It was the talk up and down the halls. It was everyone trying to identify. And I think that was one of the key issues. What can I do? How can I get involved in this? What needs to be done? And unfortunately, it was, you know, there were any number of people who wanted to be involved and concerned. But there are only a few players that could actually do anything. I think there was real concern. And then there was a real mobilization of, we need to start monitoring the markets. What's going to happen? Who's going to be next? I mean, there were, you know, I would have thought you might have gotten this already. That's why I didn't. It was... very significant. These are very significant times, and there was a lot of concern.
Was there some kind of competition to become involved with the? Well, Bear Stearns was gone at that point, so
no,
people were sort
gone.
Of holding up their hands and saying, "How can I help?" And
right. And I think the issue. I have to admit, I don't really recall everything, but I can imagine probably what happened. was is that coming right back, there was a lot of analysis to be done as to who might be next. What's going, you know, and how is it? And I think there was a lot of, okay, with Bear Stearns, what are all the particulars? Mm-hmm. And what is it impacting? And what are the impacts on the market? And what are the potential knock-on effects to other institutions? Yeah, I think there were all of those questions being investigated.
So you've been here for 20 years. There, that must be one of the banner days or the red letter days at the Fed, I would guess.
You're asking me personally. These were very significant, and I have to admit I wasn't as involved in a lot of these things as I had been in. So for me, some of my most significant events were at Bankers Trust. I sat across the table from the guys,
right.
You know, at LTCM, it was up in Connecticut. I mean, I closed this little bank, All First, in Baltimore. I was involved in a lot of other things, and I think just because of the structure that we had at the time, me personally, I wasn't as involved as I had been in the past.
Well, I think
the
situation.
So that's why it's hard
there?
To.
Yeah.
Were you more involved in what came out?
Bear Stearns hedge funds.
When the hedge funds.
Yeah, but that was just kind of a counterparty market. That was just a market counterparty issue and an investor issue. And yes, I think I probably wrote a memo or two on it to senior management here, because I was one of the few people with background in asset management.
Are we done?
I have just one other question about it. This goes even farther back, predating the Fed. So, you were at Freddie Mac when the sort of the early days of securitization?
Yeah, in 1986.
Yeah. And the first CMO?
Came out, I was there for A through M series in 86.
What was it that was securitized in that transaction?
Oh, just basic Freddie Mac pass-throughs. And that was basically the science of taking the CMOs are taking the interest rate risk,
right,
and just carving off the cash flows based on different.
Did those days seem primitive now?
They were. The computers didn't need cards for them, but you know. But the computers are, you know, and that's the other thing that you need to keep in mind with regard to VAR and the improvement of VAR models and stuff. You know, a lot of the rules that were developed in 95, 97, whatever, were based on the technology at the time. Now, there's no excuse for some of the burden.
I suppose the interest rate like risk that. Model is easier to calculate in terms of structuring the tranches on the CMOs to deal with the prepayment and other interest rate risks compared to credit risks. And so that the structure was, the model that structure was probably...
Just to identify prepayment risk at the time was new.
Yeah.
People don't realize, we take for granted now that back in the early 80s, you didn't have pass-throughs. You didn't know what a CPR was. These were pioneering days. Which is why, and you're right, it turned out to be easier. But, you know, it took 20 years for credit to come by for the CDOs.
I went in and looked at the first modeling of interest rate risk at NCMG, took a group, board guy. They were using this new product called Sendera. They couldn't, differentiate between just for a fixed rate mortgage.
I could talk for days on this stuff because you've been around here for a while.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.